Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and with me is Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Hello, Teresa.
Hello. How are you today?
I'm doing great. It's hot and humid in November, but what the heck?
I was so surprised. I, you know, got ready to go for my walk this morning, and I put on my jacket and went out and walked to the end of the block and went, okay, we're taking this layer off.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I was so surprised, but it was beautiful. It's a gorgeous day outside.
Well, you know what they say about St. Louis weather. We're certainly experiencing it.
You never know what it's going to be tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. So,
but we know we're talking about the French Revolution today.
We are.
We're in
the middle of the revolt again.
Yeah. It's some really interesting stuff, and it's got a lot of implications for what's going on in the contemporary church. Not so much from a church-state point of view, but rather when you think of things that are happening in various countries, especially in China today, of an official state Catholic church in China, and then the underground church, which is in union with the Holy Father, the parallel between that and what happened in France in the 1790s is pretty interesting. And here's one of those cases where maybe we can learn an important lesson from history.
That would be good. Let's hope we take note.
Yeah, let's hope we do, yeah. Well, I think we left off the other day talking about the sort of the devolution of the French Revolution, that it begins really with aristocrats.
That's right.
In their strike against absolutism. Mm-hmm. They succeed in that, but literally within weeks of their success, it's then ripped away from them by the upper bourgeoisie as they form together in that tennis court at Versailles, formed together the National Assembly. And now they've got the great success. And they hold that success for less than 2 months because you have the mobs that rushed into the Bastille, took over that, and then later the upper bourgeoisie, the nobles, the bishops who were there, make that Night of the Great Donation in August of 1789, and then many of them just flee France. They become this émigré all over the United States. Some of them come to the United States. Others go to Belgium, to Germany, to Russia, Italy, trying to get away from this revolution. And sure enough, within a very short time, you have a mob of people, several thousand, some 7,000 in October of 1789, that march all the way out to Versailles, which is about 23 miles from Paris.
That's a pretty good little hike.
Yeah, that is a heck of a walk. And they basically nab the royal family and the National Assembly, forcing them to come back to Paris. And now the assembly meetings are in public, and so you have demagogues, members of this group called the Jacobin Club, and they then use the power of the mob in order to force certain legislation to take place. So you can see the how the revolution has devolved from that one all the way down. It is certainly not what what the Enlightenment thought that they were going to be able to pull off. They do create one great document. It's called the Declaration of Rights of Man and Citizen. It's based on the contract theory, basically. And then, of course, in 1792, the other document which is so important to church history is the Civil Constitution of the Clergy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in this document that you have church lands confiscated, the clergy, in a sense, confiscated. They would now be paid by the state. They're now state officials, so now they're under the control of the state. The churches themselves are seized by the government, and they'll be maintained by the government as much as the government might want to do that. Dioceses are reorganized along the lines of administrative districts, and the priests will now be elected by the people, bishops appointed by the assemblies in the various French departments. And of course, Pope Pius VI was powerless to do anything to stop this. It simply was happening. Interestingly enough, that as you look throughout the French Church, only seven bishops will sign on to this. The others leave. Most of them left France. about 50% of the priests of France refused to sign on to this too. They're known in history as the refractory priest or the non-juring clergy. These lived a very dangerous life after that. They could be at any time, well, they would be subjected to persecution, mm-hmm. To arrest, and in some cases, as we'll see later on, were actually put to death for that decision that they made. It was also not undangerous for those who signed on to become juring clergy or constitutional clergy, because the vast majority of Catholics, devout Catholics, resented them and did not recognize them as legitimate priests.
Uh-huh.
And so in many cases they were sent out to various localities, cities and parishes, country parishes, and no one came to them. So they were pretty much isolated themselves.
Wow. You know.
All of this really comes to a head in 1792, the year after the Civil Constitution, when the masses were being boycotted by the people, the non-juring bishops, though many of them had fled the country, had declared that the juring bishops, those who stayed behind and informed them, the French Catholic Church, the mm-hmm. state church, they were declared to be their sacraments were declared invalid.
Okay.
Eventually, the Pope will rule that they are a schismatic church.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. At the same time, this is happening on the religious scene. On the military scene, things are very tense for the French also. The Austrian army, the Austrian Empire, has assembled its army and is marching toward France. It's marching across Germany, and it is joined by the Prussian army to do the same. And then what they're attempting to do is to restore the monarchy.
Okay.
You know, this is a very interesting turn of events, because the Prussians and the Austrians and the French have often fought wars one against the other, bitter
uh-huh.
wars,
uh-huh.
throughout the 18th century. And now, at the end of the 18th century, these two monarchs are sending their armies in to help the King of France.
Huh. Uh-huh.
You know, I guess they recognized that the revolution was destroying social order as they understood it, and something had to be done to stop that. All of this put incredible pressure on the people of France. As those two armies entered French territory and headed toward the city of Paris itself, the commander of one of the armies, I think it was the Austrian army, had sent word to the people of Paris that if any harm came to the king or queen, that he would draw up his artillery and bombard the city of Paris.
Wow.
And so all that stood between the Parisians and these two advancing armies was a French army that had never been tried before, because they had dismantled the old French army. The officers, had many of them had fled also. And so this new French army that they had was untried. It was made up of volunteers and of draftees. They had passed a law called the Levée en Masse, in which they went through and just drafted hundreds of thousands of French into this army. They were untrained. They had the weapons were not the best in the world. And that little ragtag army was all that stood between the two. And so in the midst of this cauldron, this pressure cooker, already some 20 priests had been arrested. These were non-juring clergy mm-hmm. that had been found in Paris. They were sent to a jail in Paris, and the people knew about these 20 priests who were there. And in September of 1792, a mob assembled outside of this. This is on the 3rd of September of 1792. A mob gathered outside of this jail, and they demanded that the priests be brought out and executed immediately. And the jailers tried to put up some resistance, but ultimately they let this mob go in and take these 20 priests, and they were slaughtered. Eventually, that led to a widespread riot throughout Paris, mm-hmm. in which it went on from the 3rd to the 5th of September. So it was a two-day almost a 3-day riot in which some 220 priests were found and murdered, as well as 3 bishops and a slew of nuns and brothers were also rounded up and murdered at this time. Tremendous bloodlust.
So who did this, Father?
These were Parisians. These were average citizens of Paris. It was a mob. It was a revolutionary mob.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, we're going to see why they were all whipped up.
Okay.
And it's very interesting how this happens. These are not good Catholic Frenchmen.
Mm-hmm. So it was mostly the country citizens who supported the non-juring. And
correct.
Not the city.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. There'll be whole areas of France that will remain loyal to the church,
mm-hmm.
Whereas in many of the large cities, the urban mobs will be on the other side.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. Ultimately, about a thousand churchmen will be killed.
My goodness.
In this September massacre and the days that follow afterwards.
So they'd be martyrs for the faith.
They really are, and very few of them have been named as such. There are a couple that have been named, and I'll see if I can't get a little list of those, but the vast majority of them are not. And as I thought about this, you know, I thought the same thing about their martyrdom, and I thought about the Book of Revelations when it talks about the sea of white-robed martyrs standing uh-huh. around the throne, and that we don't know all the names of that sea, but
sure.
definitely these were there. And besides these, I mean, there will be thousands of other peasants who were killed. There's a terrible story of a bunch of peasants loyal to the church who were rounded up and taken and put on barges to be shipped down the Rhone River. They thought they were being shipped to exile. What happened was when they got out into the middle of the river, the revolutionary guards who had tied them up and put them on this barge pulled the plug on the barges and sank them right in the middle of the river.
Oh, my gosh.
And there were all kinds of stories of people that died in this this way. In 1792 and then in 1793, interestingly enough, and we see this often, the term that that revolutions eat their children.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing happened to the Civil Constitutionary Church. The revolution turned on the Constitutionary Church, which the Civil Church, which is really kind of ironic in a sense. These are the people who had abandoned the faith of their fathers, the ancient faith of ancient France, the eldest daughter of the church, and they had sided then on the government side. They were receiving a salary from the government, And then all of a sudden, they themselves become the persecuted.
Uh-huh.
So in other words, the Civil Constitution Church actually had about 1 year. By selling their soul,
uh-huh.
they got about 1 year of peace.
Uh-huh.
And then after that, everything fell apart. And as you look at that and read about that, historians try to figure out, why did that happen? How did that happen? And I've come to the conclusion that there are two things involved in this. One was that there were some individuals who had real individual problems with the church.
Mm-hmm.
And these were not necessarily the best and the brightest. They're not the Voltaires and the Rousseaus and the Locke and all of that. These were lesser known people, two in particular that I came across. You have that, and then you also have an audience that is not terribly well educated, but well educated enough to be dangerous.
Yeah, right. You know? That's always a problem.
Yeah, yeah. And as I was thinking about where could I come up with a modern example of this, to tell you the truth, and I hope I don't offend anybody at this, but I thought about George Carlin.
Okay.
You know, here's a guy in the 1960s who was very popular, is today still very popular comedian in the United States, but he is profane. He is his use of language is terrible. And then I saw a biography on him a little while ago, and they did a section in which he lampooned religion.
Okay.
You know, and it was not particularly brilliant in what he said, but it was very comical, and he had this audience laughing. And when you think about the millions of people who have listened to his tapes or his records or seen him live and have been impressed with his theology, which is not anything, but I think he has probably influenced tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people in their own abandonment of the faith. And interestingly enough, here's a man who's not terribly well educated himself. Don't believe he ever finished college. Maybe he didn't go to college. But he was educated. In his grade school education, he was educated in a Catholic school.
Huh, okay.
You know? So he took what education he had, and then he turned it on the church.
Right.
And the same thing is true about these people who really led the attack on the church. They're not coming from the Enlightenment. They're coming from a boiled-down version, a popularized version of the Enlightenment. And they're appealing to this urban mass of modestly educated people, you know,
right,
and they're easily able to convince them, and so they have tremendous power, but no authority.
You know,
I think also of, quite honestly, of the early 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century, of racists in Europe, and I think of people like Adolf Hitler, who was not terribly well educated himself, you know, never saw the inside of a college, and yet at the same time had these really bizarre race theories, the anti-Semitic race theories, and he got those from comic books. You know, he wasn't even reading the elevated intellectual anti-Semites.
Right.
He was getting this stuff from comic books, and then he turns around and influences millions of people with his kind of bizarre, well, very bizarre ideas. And we can see this time and time again in history when you have somebody hitting a nerve and then it taking off. Well, in the case of the French in 1792 and 93, two individuals that you've probably never heard of before and will never hear of again had this influence. One of them was Joseph Fouché.
Okay.
And the other was a fellow by the name of Hébert.
Okay.
And Fouché was the, he had a very powerful position. He was the director of the secret state police.
Oh, okay.
He is a survivor. We'll talk a little bit later on about another survivor. That's being Talleyrand. Uh-huh. But Fouché is a real survivor, too. He survives throughout the entire French Revolutionary period by shifting sides. He has a dossier on everybody. He's got the goods on everybody. And it sort of reminds you a bit of this Russian KGB fellow by the name of Beria, who had the goods on everybody throughout the period of the Soviet Union. And anyway, that's what he had going for him. And just an incredible hatred of the Catholic Church. Just incredible. He went to the cathedral at Nevers, which is located, I guess, about 60 or 80 miles south of Paris. And there he denounced from the bishop's cathedra, from the bishop's chair, denounced the Catholic faith. He announced that all clergy were to marry, whether they like it or not. And then he then went ahead and confiscated all of the vestments from the cathedral, which he then took home and used for parties. They would dress up in his parties and use the vestments as costumes and things. Just an incredible fellow. Even the civil constitution bishops were upset. Many of them then left France also and fled. Later he went on to Rheims, to that beautiful cathedral there, that great ancient Catholic city, and did the same thing there, Amiens and Bourges, a number of other places. And some of the bishops caved in and followed him.
Mm.
One of those was the Archbishop of Paris, a diminutive little toady by the name of Gobel. And ultimately, the revolution came to get him also.
Mm-hmm.
Late one night, a crowd broke into his residence, woke him up, and forced him to give up his crozier and his mitre and put on the red cap of the revolution. And after they paraded him around for a while, then just basically dumped him, and he abdicated his own position as the constitutional bishop. Yeah. The other, as I mentioned, was Hébert, who was a propagandist, and we'll see a little bit later on how some of the things that he did. This really went over the top, and on November 10th of 1793. The cathedral itself, the Notre Dame, was seized by the government, and a special service was held in which in the sanctuary, all the Catholic trappings were removed, and a woman was dressed up in a Greek outfit. She had actually been like a vaudeville popular dancer. And she was brought in and dressed up in a Greek outfit, and she took the position of the goddess of reason. And so there was this thing held. All churches in France were closed. Hébert wrote and argued against the church. He referred to Jesus in the following way, and well, besides the sacrilege that he's also saying, I'm also going to slaughter the French for you, but I'm going to try anyway. He says the following. He says, Le bon Saint-Culotte Jésus, modèle de tous les Jacobins. That Jesus is the good Saint-Culotte. That's the urban people. They're called Saint-Culotte because they wore long pants. Remember?
Okay.
And so he says, the good Saint-Culotte Jesus, model of all the Jacobin, and that he had been hijacked by the Catholic Church and all. There's a little bit of liberation theology in that concept. The government then goes absolutely over the top, crazy. They even went into all the churches in France, and whenever you found a church with a clock in a tower, they broke the clock so that it wouldn't work. Now, why on earth do that? They claimed that clocks, that this was a sign of church superiority.
A clock?
A clock. Well, people would listen, you know, they'd hear the clock
ring. Hear the church bells ring.
Hear the church bells ring, hear the church clock, and go,
oh,
well,
their prayers.
it's 9 o'clock. So who's telling them it's 9 o'clock? The Catholic Church. Oh, isn't that stupid?
That's incredible.
It got worse.
I was thinking back to the Chinese when they brought him a clock and how fascinated he was with the clock. And here we're stooping down to thinking.
Yeah, we're ruining the clocks. They passed a law saying that a week will now be 10 days long rather than 7.
Oh, my God.
That went over like a lead balloon.
I bet it did.
Because that meant you only had a day off every 10 days rather than every 7. Well, duh. Talk about a no-brainer on that one. They then passed a law, you know, following Fouché's suggestion that every Catholic priest must be married. Now, these are, of course, the juring clergy. These are the civil constitution clergy. The clergy loyal to the Holy Father have gone underground. Okay, and obviously they're being hidden by lots of people, very heroic. The juring clergy were then told to marry. Historians have pointed out that in many cases what they did was they went down to the local registry and registered their marriage. This was not a religious service. This was a civil service. They went down and registered In many cases, they simply brought the old cleaning lady or the cook for the rectory down, and she officially then became his wife. So you can imagine, you know, a priest who might be 35 years old, and he goes to the registry tongue-in-cheek, and her tongue-in-cheek, she's 73, and they're now man and wife in the eyes of the church. So, I mean, the eyes of the state. So there was a lot of that going on. But it was that's one thing for the priest to get away with. It was another thing for the bishops.
Uh-huh.
Now, by now, there were 85 bishops in France that were civil constitution bishops.
Okay.
Remember, seven had signed on.
Mm-hmm.
Then others were created. At this time, when they were told they must marry in order to continue to be bishops, and at the same time, it's very clear all of their cathedrals have been closed down. You know, it's real clear that they're out of a job real soon anyway. 24 of the 85 abdicated.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many of these are bishops who were made bishops by the government.
Okay.
And yet, they resisted the their own government. So that means that 61 of them did agree to do this and become basically toadies of the government. They were then told not only to marry, but also to denounce the Catholic Church. And of this 61, only 23 of them did. This is dangerous for those people to do this, and yet they've
already seen many get rounded up and killed.
Yeah, that's right. Of the 23 that denounced the church, only 9 of them actually married, and went along with the government.
Okay.
Only 9.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so really, when you look at it, this is an incredible, very dangerous resistance on their part to have done this, and yet they did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of these actions ended up being too much, even for many of the revolutionaries. And in January of 1793, the Jacobin got control of the central government, and you had riots going on. You had bread riots going on, draft riots going on in the countryside. Pro-church riots going on, cities in revolt, and so the government then turned to the director of the Committee of Public Safety.
Okay.
This would be the equivalent of the director of FEMA.
Okay.
Okay, the Federal Emergency Management.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And his name is Maximilien Robespierre.
Okay.
He is notorious. And yet, actually, the actions that had taken place in 92 were actually more notorious than what he himself does. But I guess he's best known because he's absolutely ruthless. And he causes measures to take place in France that will become part and parcel of the French government that do endure. Fouché and Hébert do not.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, Hébert is guillotined himself. Anyhow, you have Robespierre coming in. By the way, I should mention that the French army that was standing in the way of the Prussian and Austrian armies, the two professional armies, actually won the battle.
Oh, they did.
They did. Believe it or not, it's known as the Battle of Valmy, and it was outside of Paris. What happened was some very unfortunate mistakes were made by the professional army.
Uh-huh.
For one thing, they began the attack with a barrage of cannonball, and they used a round shot. These are like, if you can imagine, a small bowling ball or a bocce ball of pure lead, and they fired those at the French, but it had rained the day before. And so instead of bouncing as they normally would, they got embedded into the mud.
Uh-huh.
And so their attack was unsuccessful. The French responded by their own barrage, which was not particularly professional because these guys weren't. But they used shells that exploded, and into shrapnel. That would have some effect, but one of those shells you couldn't pull this off on purpose, but it came down and it hit a wagon.
Okay. Oh.
Full of munitions.
Oh my God.
Which happened to be attached to a whole bunch of wagons full of munitions and blew
just
up a lot of the
supplies
of the Austrians and Prussians. So as I say, they lost the battle. They're now retreating out of France, and now Robespierre has the opportunity to actually exert some influence.
Okay.
He believes that Catholicism is incompatible with the ideals of the revolution, but he also believes that the universe is too complex and too extraordinary to be an accident. There has to have been some intelligent designer. There has to have been a God to do this, and he believes that deism is important for the maintenance of society.
Okay.
And so what he does is he replaces this anarchy and atheism that Fouché and Hébert had introduced. He replaces it with a state religion based upon deism.
Mm-hmm.
It's known as the cult of the supreme being.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And with that, he oversaw the what becomes known as the Reign of Terror.
Mm-hmm.
This is systematic terror. You're not going to have widespread riots and lawlessness anymore. Now it's going to be systematized. And, of course, he'll use Fouché and the secret state police to round up any possible enemies that might be coming down the pike. And that, of course, is also going to include Catholic priests,
mm-hmm.
Those who are dissenting
mm-hmm.
Catholic priests. Maximilien Robespierre, even then, as he believes the importance of religion in the public arena, actually takes on not only all the other constitutional roles that he might have, but he also makes himself the high priest of the cult of the supreme being. And he presides at services at what had been the Notre Dame Cathedral.
Okay.
That's something.
Yeah.
Two areas in particular, he will crush Catholic revolts against the central government in Lyon, in southern France,
mm-hmm.
and then also in Toulon. In Toulon, there will be a massacre in the plaza of hundreds and hundreds of people. As I mentioned before about the sinking of boats full of people, that took place within over about a 15-month period, partially during his Reign of Terror, something to the tune of 2,639 people were executed. For being enemies of the state. The way to do this was, is famous, of course, as the guillotine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The guillotine, of course, was invented by Dr. Guillotin mm-hmm. as a humane way of committing capital execution.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, ultimately, Dr. Guillotin was guillotined.
Was guillotined.
Yeah. In the end, some 20,000 people were killed during this Reign of Terror. 20,000. It wasn't, and including in that, of course, will be King Louis XVI and his wife, Queen Marie Antoinette.
Mm-hmm.
The Reign of Terror itself will come to an end only by July of 1795.
Wow.
Everyone was afraid of Robespierre.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, in July of 1795, at a meeting of the National Assembly, Joseph Fouché stood up and denounced him.
Oh, okay.
He then ordered Fouché arrested. Yeah. And instead, the sergeant-at-arms and the guards who were there at the National Assembly had been replaced by Fouché.
Uh-huh.
So instead of arresting him, they went to arrest Robespierre.
Okay.
A famous scene happens then at this point. Robespierre escapes from the building, makes his way over across the street to his apartment. He is followed by a crowd of a couple hundred people out for his blood. And when they got up to his apartment, he was standing there with a pistol.
Uh-huh.
Of course, you know, a pistol has one shot.
Uh-huh.
And so he puts it to his head and says, "If you come any closer, I'll fire it, the pistol." Well, they lunged, of course. And he fired the pistol. he was nervous and did not shoot his brains out. What he did was he shot his jaw off.
Oh.
And so they called for a doctor immediately, and they stopped the bleeding and nursed him back to health. And a couple of days later, guillotined him. Now, if you were that doctor, wouldn't you feel bad about that?
Oh, my gosh.
There is another little tragedy that takes place in this French Revolution, and I've got to talk about this. It's I came across an article when I was pulling all of this together and did a little experiment in it, too. And so I'd just like to talk about the decline and fall of that great elixir of the French, Chartreuse.
Chartreuse,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. It is one of the other little tragedies that takes place.
Okay.
You know that Carthusians, this goes back to the Middle Ages, to the 11th century with St. Bruno,
uh-huh,
and the founding of the Carthusian monks. And it's a medieval order, of course, that had been around, you know, since then. They were famous in the area of Chartreuse in southern France around Grenoble, and had a monastery there. It turns out that that someone had given, around 1600, had given the monks a formula for producing what was known as an elixir, something that would keep you healthy. And it was very, very complex. It was a long list of different ingredients.
Okay.
And these are various herbs and roots,
okay,
and all kinds of stuff. And as I say, it was an elixir of life, or what they referred to as an aqua vita.
Okay.
I remember talking to a French Christian brother years back in the city of Nancy, and as we were about to leave, he said, "Oh, you need to have a farewell drink, you know." It's, it was a congé, you know, they called it a congé. So we all had a little bit of this aqua vita that his family brewed. He had the rights to brew this stuff.
Wow.
And he said, "Do you know what this is called?" And I said, "Well, it's an aqua vita." And he goes, "Yes, the water of life." And then he had a twinkle in his eye and he said, "But be careful, because too much water of life leads to death." So it's good to keep in mind. Well, what happened was that the monks figured this out. They had a couple herbalists who figured this formula out, which came to them, as I say, in 1605.
Okay.
And they produced it for 132 years, mainly for their own consumption and for the local consumption of the people in the area. But in the area around Chartreuse, it was very famous.
Uh-huh.
And people believed that it had certain medicinal purposes to it. In 1793, as I say, this is one of the little tragedies of the French Revolution, the order was suppressed,
okay,
and with it was the production of Chartreuse. And the order was dispersed.
Okay.
Many of the monks left France and went over across the border to Switzerland. Others fled to Italy, Spain, in particular. One monk was left behind in the monastery to basically be a caretaker for the monastery. And he received a manuscript on how to make this stuff.
Okay.
Another fled to Bordeaux in southern France. He was arrested, but he was not searched. And so he maintained the copy of the manuscript. A third copy was smuggled by a monk over to the Swiss border.
Okay.
He got over into the Swiss border, but before he did, he had to get rid of the manuscript, and so he gave it to a pharmacist in Grenoble.
Okay.
Uh-huh. A French city in southern France along the Swiss border, and there it sat. So we lost the one copy in Bordeaux. Don't know what happened to it. We had the copy that's hidden at Chartreuse,
uh-huh,
and then the other copy that is now in the hands of a pharmacist in Grenoble.
Okay.
It is so complex, he can't figure it out either.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, when Napoleon, we'll be talking about Napoleon a little bit later on, when Napoleon became the first consul and then ultimately the emperor, he established the Ministry of Health in Paris, and within that there was a sub-department of pharmaceuticals.
Okay.
And this sub-department sent an order out to all pharmacists all throughout France to send every formula they had for medicine to this central committee,
okay,
which would then rule on whether or not these were actually medicines or not, and then put together a book of medicine. You know, it's a wonderful step forward.
Okay.
And then this way they would be taking a lot of herbal remedies and everything else, and then finding out which is good and which is not. Well, this Grenoble pharmacist dutifully sent the manuscript to Paris. And the interesting thing is that when it got to Paris, the pharmacists there, that pharmaceutical committee, were trying out all of these different things. Ultimately, when they took a look at the chartreuse formula, it was so complex that they said, we can't do this. It mustn't be right. This can't be right. And so they put it aside just set it in their archives. In 1816, the year after Napoleon was defeated at Waterloo, and the new king was restored to the monarchy was restored to France, and everything was fine, the various religious orders, one by one, were invited back into France. And in 1816, the Carthusians then returned to their monastery at Chartreuse. Remember the Grenoble
pharmacist?
The committee had sent the manuscript back to him saying that it was too complex and couldn't possibly work. He had died by now,
okay,
but his children still had the formula, and they knew where it had come from, and so they returned the manuscript back to the monks.
Oh, wow.
That's something?
Yeah.
And so then that's exactly what they did, and the monks got back into the pharmaceutical work themselves, the herbalists. They began rooting up the roots. They began finding the various herbs and leaves and all the other stuff. And sure enough, they began producing chartreuse over again.
Wow.
This continued until 1903.
Okay.
Okay. And in 1903, there was a new French government that was anti-clerical, anti-church, and they nationalized everything,
mm-hmm,
including the monastery at Chartreuse and the method of making chartreuse. And the monks then had to leave France. They fled to Spain,
okay,
where they were given a monastery to stay at. This is Tarragona, I believe. And anyway, they went ahead and they set up and began making chartreuse there. In 1929, they were invited back to France. They returned back, but the state, which had been trying to make the chartreuse, had failed to do so. It was terrible stuff. It had gone out of business, and so anyway, they are about to come back to their monastery when, remember that chartreuse is nestled in the Chartreuse Mountains.
Okay.
It was an avalanche, and it destroyed the monastery.
Oh, my gosh.
And the distillery in the process. So the monks then settled down, and they built a new distillery not far away at Farron, I believe it is. And so it's actually produced to this day. There are 130 herbs and roots and different things in the ingredients in making the chartreuse.
Is that right? Oh,
yeah.
My gosh.
And after reading about this, I thought, this is so interesting. And so I was at, I went down to a fine restaurant, one of the mm-hmm. finest restaurants in St. Louis, great supporter of the radio station at Kimmel's.
Oh, yes.
And I asked for a sniffer of chartreuse. And it was recommended in the article I read to not drink it, but to smell it. And so I did. I spent about 10 minutes just sniffing it. And it is incredible, the different smells that come out of this this one little elixir.
I guess I should have read that article first. Because I tasted it.
Oh, you did.
And I maybe should have just smelled it.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's an experience. But it just goes to show you, it's one more little facet of the French Revolution that has all kinds of implications. I'd like to read a paragraph from a church historian. His name is E.E.Y. Hales. As he reflected on the French Revolution and especially on the Catholic Church and how the Church survived the Revolution and actually prospered through it, what was really driving it. And then we can start looking at the other side. We can start looking at it from the Pope's point of view of this. But what we've been doing so far really is looking at the people, at individuals, as individual priests, at bishops, at monks like the Carthusians that suffered so grievously under this revolution. But this is what he says. And the book is called The Catholic Church in the Modern World. And he said this. He said, amidst the persecution, the profligacy, and the prating of pompous official platitudes, the faith still lay in the breasts of brave priests crowded into prisons and onto boats, or hidden in the cellars and cupboards of hospitable houses, in the hearts of those heroic virtue who disguise themselves in order to pass among the condemned, following the very tumbrils with their words of comfort, in the bearing of some of those in exile who made profound impressions upon their hosts in Protestant countries, in the communities of nuns who adhered throughout amid every hardship to their devotions, among the faithful who contrived to find out the secret places where they could kneel behind the priest who was saying Mass. If some of the Romanists were more preoccupied in their exile with the fate of the monarchy than with the fate of the Church, if some of the bishops were blind adherents to the ancient regime, and if many of the constitutional clergy dishonored their calling, it is right that the sacrifice of the devoted during a period of extreme trial should be remembered. For without it, the remarkable revival of the Church in France in the following century is unintelligible. Mm-hmm. This is such an important insight, you know, and we'll see this as we look at the rebirth of the Church in France in the 19th century. This is a time of great saints, of apparitions, of the founding of new orders. You know, you have the Senecal sisters in the whole retreat movement founded after the French Revolution. Teresa of Lisieux, 19th century. Curé of Ars, you know, John Vianney. You have so many things happening in France. France is really a blessed country in the 19th century. And what Hales is saying in this paragraph is that, yeah, okay, there are lots of things going on, and you've got, you know, people that are bishops that are maybe more concerned about the king and the monarchy than about the Church. And then you certainly have a good number of constitutional clergy who have to go along with anything the government says. And that. But there is this huge pool of sacrifice on the part of unnamed nuns, you know, like you were talking about before, the martyrs that we don't even know the names of, and they really lay the foundation for the Church's revival shortly after. You know, isn't that something?
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I think that, I think so much of our, in times of trial, when the Church has gone underground is when you see such a great rebirth of the faith of the people after the sacrifice may be over.
Yeah, I think this is, just looking at this era of Church history gives great hope to the contemporary Church in the 21st century. If French sacrifice led to the 19th century rebirth of the Church and the flowering of the Church in France, one could only imagine what's ahead of us in the 21st century, as we see so many Chinese who sacrifice constantly. What about Sudanese? There's so many Sudanese Christians.
Gosh.
What an area where the Church suffers there. I think of Nigeria and so many areas there that in this contest between Islam and Christianity, and how, especially in the north, how many good Christians, Catholics, and as well as Anglicans, suffer at the hands of the Sharia, the application of Islamic law to them. And, you know, the church suffers so much throughout the world. And yet at the same time, we've seen in this period of history that this suffering will pay off
right.
in the end.
Yes. Yeah. He will reward them.
Yeah. We got time to talk a little bit about the Pope?
We do. We have about 10 minutes.
Good. The Pope who basically presides over much of this is Pope Pius VI.
Okay.
And here's a little interesting fun fact. The year that he was elected Pope is the same year that a bunch of Massachusetts farmers fired on British troops at Lexington and Concord. He was elected that same year.
Okay.
The year he died is the year that Napoleon seized control of France.
Okay.
So he really is living during the age of revolution.
Yes.
You know. We talked a little bit about his election earlier on from the point of view of Cardinal de Berry and how he had manipulated the council or the conclave and tried to manipulate it to get him elected, Pius VI elected, mainly because of his sympathies for the Jesuits and others. By now, the former Jesuits. Interestingly enough, the former general of the Jesuit order at the time of this conclave was actually being held prisoner at Castel San Angelo.
Oh, really?
That's something, yeah. And and then Pius intended to release him. However, he died. Father Ricci actually died before the Pope arrived in Rome. He was 72 years old and just died of old age. But when Pius VI did arrive in Rome, he found it impossible to reinstate the Jesuits, to reestablish the order. But what he did was he helped in the running of some of the former Jesuit schools, and he was able to keep those functioning, especially in Prussia, which is interesting because Prussia is not a Catholic country. It was a Calvinist country. Prussia is that northeastern part of present-day Germany.
Okay.
You know? But through the support of Frederick II, who is by no means pro-Catholic, nonetheless was very much pro-education. And so the Jesuits, former Jesuits, were able then to, they're still priests, were able to operate these schools and basically in everything but name continue on. In the Society of Jesus. He also made sure that there were others that were able to migrate to Russia, where under Catherine II, Catherine the Great, they also were able to maintain themselves.
Okay.
And he sort of looked the other way so that they were able to do this. He found himself crossing swords with the Emperor of Austria, which is really interesting because the Austrians, the Habsburgs, had always been so supportive of, of the church, sometimes at odds with the popes as to how to support the church, but always supportive. And certainly the previous monarch, the Empress Maria Theresia, was a very, very strong Catholic, daily communicant. She and her husband attended Mass daily. And however, her son, who inherited the throne, Joseph II, was not of the same spirit. He was a thoroughly Enlightenment kind of a guy.
Okay.
And his intention was to secularize Austria, which is hard to even imagine.
Very hard.
Yeah, it really is. But that was his goal, to secularize the Austrian empire and to do it through education, which would mean then to get rid of all Catholic schools. It's a movement that's referred to as Josephism.
Okay,
the secularization of government. The historian Craig says the following. He said, "Reason was to govern affairs, and the power of the state was to act as a servant of reason." That's a lovely idea. You know. And so he saw his role as a king, as a sovereign, to place the church in its proper context, as he understood that. First of all, he believed that the church should be run under what he referred to, what Emperor Joseph referred to as the primitive constitution.
Okay.
Now, the primitive constitution from his mindset is what the church looked like before Constantine.
Okay.
Okay. No role in society.
Mm-hmm.
It was to be purely a spiritual organization, which would be a department of the state. It's not too far off from what the French were trying to do over in the French Revolution a couple years later.
Uh-huh.
You know. So the church then would be a department of the state solely for the purpose of the spiritual development of the people. Education would be universal but secular.
Uh-huh.
His goal was to make it the best education in all of Europe. The universities, he began reforming the universities. He began spending lots of money on attracting the best minds at the universities, except in the fields of philosophy and theology. So engineering, business, science, those things would be made all the more powerful. A revealing insight into the mind of Joseph II comes from this quote of his. He said this. He says, "We have weakened deep-rooted traditions by the introduction of enlightened principles." One way to do this was to break the Austrian church away from Rome as much mm-hmm. as possible. And Pope Pius V did a very courageous thing, something that popes didn't do back in those days. He actually traveled to the Imperial Empire to plead. This was in 1782.
Wow.
To plead to the emperor to rethink his position. So it was a very brave thing on the part of
Pius
VI. Yeah.
Right.
So this is that leadership that, as we go into the our next program, we'll be looking at Pius VI and then Pius VII, two just really incredible leaders of the church at a time when the church really needed
mm-hmm.
leadership.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Father. Very
okay.
interesting show. So we close with a prayer?
Let's do. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning,
is now,
and ever shall be, world without end.
Amen.
And would you give our listeners your blessing?
May Almighty God bless us all. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Amen. Thank you, Father.
Okay.